Welcome to The Last Post, Professor Dale Stevens, and thank you very much for sparing us your time.
No worries, Greg. No worries at all.
That's wonderful. Dale, you're Director of Uni Adelaide's Research Unit on Military Law and Ethics. For those that don't know of the work that you're doing, could you just explain to us what that entails?
Sure. So we are a research unit within the law school of the University of Adelaide, and our focus is to look at the manner in which the law operates in respect of military operations, principally, but also looking at things like research into veterans community, and particularly in terms of incarceration and connections with military service. But also the word Rumley, which is our title, Research Unit on Military Law and Ethics, the E in Rumley does stand for something. And so part of our research is looking at the way ethical choices are made in terms of operations and contrasting that with the law. So looking at the relationship between law and ethical choices that are made by commanders in the execution of military operations.
Very, very interesting. And of course, it entails a lot there. And I guess, first up with the veterans and the rate of incarceration, etc., through their military service or effect. What have you found there?
So we've got Kelly Toole, who is a lecturer, senior lecturer at the university, and a former criminal lawyer. Her research is principally focused on looking at and Elaine Waddell, sorry, is her co-researcher, looking at the rate of incarceration of ADF members or ex-ADF members and trying to work out whether there are any connections between prison and their service. And the study is only a couple of years old, and so it's only preliminary findings at the moment, but there does seem to be an over-representation compared to the general population of the ADF in civilian prison. And the goal is to try and work out whether there is a connection. So Kelly's research is still ongoing, but the preliminary findings that she's got, which are yet to be further interrogated, are that military service actually, from what we gather, is that the individuals who come to the ADF, they find a lot of camaraderie, they find a sense of belonging, they're instilled with a sense of discipline when they're in the ADF. And then when they leave, that discipline, that sense of camaraderie seems to evaporate. And they, if they're broken people when they come into the ADF puts a lid on some of that social pressure, I guess. And when they leave the ADF, that lid's taken off, and they do silly things, and they can end up in jail. And so this is the study that that Kelly is doing at the moment. But it's only preliminary. We've only looked at statistics in South Australia. We're trying to expand that research into other states, and we're looking particularly at New South Wales, which has a much higher, broader sample rate, I guess, of ADF members. And so
yes,
that will be, I think, the moment where we'll be able to validate the preliminary findings that we're finding here in South Australia.
That promises to be very interesting, Dale. We get obviously the more numbers attached to New South Wales, which will give it broader acceptability, I guess, within the confines of what you're studying.
That's right. That's right. So I think we need to just see if what we're finding here is replicated in other states, and if it is, then I think we can start making some conclusions about how the ADF might want to the ADF and the Department of Veterans Affairs might want to deal with this issue, and hopefully try and encourage some policy changes that might protect, if you like, and care for our ex-members in a manner that at least stops them going to jail.
Yeah.
If that's the conclusion.
Yes, that's right. I was thinking the same thing myself, and obviously, if this leads to an impacting on governments and those responsible to change laws and attitudes towards veterans, it will be for the betterment of the community. What do you see being wrong with that at the moment?
Well, I think at the moment it's not that. I think for the Department of Defence, once the member leaves the ADF and becomes a veteran, there seems to be a bureaucratic firewall, and it's no longer a responsibility of the ADF. It now belongs to the Department of Veterans Affairs or other social departments, and so social care departments. So it becomes. I think that creating that link, accepting that when you're an ADF member, when you leave the ADF, that there are things that the ADF can do while that member is in service, or at least be on the lookout for when they make that transition, that there's a level of care and concern, I think. Mm. The other thing I've got to say, Greg, is that we've had here in South Australia, we've had enormous support from the veterans community, and the veterans organisations have been very, very helpful to us in gaining access to ex-ADF members and providing ongoing commentary themselves about experiences. So that's a relationship that has developed that has been quite helpful to our research.
Yes, that's that. Actually, the South Australian government, I think Dale is well respected for its work with the veterans and the veteran community. Where it doesn't matter particularly whether it's Liberal or Labor, but they seem to be doing well, I think, through Veterans SA and some other things as well.
Yeah, no, we've been very, very happy. In fact, we've had also the Department of Correctional Services here in South Australia has been individuals in that department. I think very concerned, and we've been working with them as well. So it's been very helpful. Though I must confess, Greg, in talking to you, it's a project that Kelly leads. I'm engaging with Kelly on this, but she is a criminal lawyer, and so this is of great interest to her. And so we talk, and I support her study, but she's taking the lead in this particular research.
Yes, that's wonderful, and we might catch up with Kelly in the near future to expand on that even more, Dale. But
that'd be great.
Yeah, no, I think it's essential for readers and listeners to know what's going on behind the scenes. A lot of it not often promoted, but you've had an amazing career, Dale, and you're still relatively young. You've been in the Navy for 20 years, or...?
Yeah, I joined the Navy in 1989, so I've been in the Navy 31 years.
Wow, apologies, I missed out on 11 important years then. Jeez, that's incredible. And what, twice you've been to East Timor?
Yes, so it was interesting, I joined the Navy in 1989, and that corresponded, I guess, with Australia engaging militarily in the world, starting with the first Gulf War in 1990. And so when I joined as a young legal officer in the Navy, in the ADF, RENADF, we went to the Gulf War. We then were engaged in peacekeeping in Cambodia. We went to Rwanda. We went to Bougainville. And, of course, at the end of the 1990s, we deployed to East Timor, and I deployed to East Timor with Interfet initially, and then came back to Australia, and then redeployed to East Timor with UNTAYET, which was the UN peacekeeping or the UN sponsored mission in East Timor. Mm. And in both instances, I was a legal advisor. In the first instance, with Interfet, to the naval commander of the Interfet forces, and then in the second instance, to the general who commanded the peacekeeping forces of East Timor, within East Timor. So, two lots of deployments to East Timor at pretty critical moments in my mind, when East Timor was transitioning from Indonesian administration to UN administration, and then to its own sovereign.
Yes,
status as a country.
It was an amazing time, Dale. And I, at the time when a lot of this was unfolding, I was up in the Whitsundays just cruising around on a yacht, and I was thinking about how close we were to this drama that was unfolding. How important was the United Nations in what happened there?
So I think you can break it down into two components, Greg. The first component was INTERFET, and the UN. There was initially some resistance by Indonesia for an international force
mm-hmm.
Entering into East Timor, and the UN sent a number of envoys to research what was going on in East Timor, and they sent back reports detailing the breakdown of security and the humanitarian concerns that they held for the people of East Timor. And the Security Council, the UN, United Nations Security Council, actually adopted a resolution, 1264, which authorised a multinational force to enter East Timor and gave full legal authority for that force to restore and maintain peace and security
yes.
in East Timor. And so We Australia led that force with INTERFET in 1999, and we had a very complete legal authority under the Security Council, the United Nations Security Council, to do what it is we needed to do to restore peace and security and to maintain it. And then that occurred up until around about November, December of 1999,
mm-hmm.
and there was a new resolution, 1272, that was adopted that actually created a UN force. So the first force was INTERFET, the second force was UNTAYET, and we put on blue helmets and blue berets when we transitioned from INTERFET to UNTAYET, and that's furthered the initial work of INTERFET in restoring and maintaining peace and security within East Timor. And when it became a fully fledged UN peacekeeping or peace enforcement operation, we had a number of other countries join. And I think at its maximum, I think there were about 26 countries that were involved in UNTAYET's mission. And that was to restore peace and security, bring people back from West Timor, to deal with the militia threat that was ongoing at the time, and to assist the United Nations Civilian Administration recreate infrastructure for the country so that it might become a functioning entity and then transition into a functioning sovereign state.
Mm. Well, it's part and parcel of what you do too, Dale. I guess it must have been very exciting to see that unfold and become a reality in the end. How did you feel about your role in that?
So thanks, Greg. It's a funny thing in your career. You find yourself at various times being involved in really big events in the world, and you find that you start providing advice on a scale that you never imagined. So for me, it was tremendously exciting. I'd been in the when I deployed to East Timor first in October 1999. I'd been in the Navy 10 years, and it was 10 years of training and preparation. So for me, it was a very exciting time to be involved in an operation that had full legal support and had the full support of the Australian population, but also had in East Timor, the people themselves were very, very grateful that we were there. So from an operational perspective, we had everything happening in the right direction, going in the right direction, full legal authority, support of our Australian population, and the gratitude of a population in East Timor that we were there to restore and maintain peace and security. So a happy convergence of legal authority and operational success at that particular time. So for me, it was wonderful. We had, from a Navy perspective with INTERFET, we had... one of the things we had to do was we had an agreement with Indonesia for an air and sea corridor between East Timor and the Akusi Enclave, which is based in West Timor, but it still is a small bit of East Timor. So it was a little component of West Timor that was East Timor.
Mm.
So it wasn't Indonesia, and we had air and sea corridor where we could fly and sail, and we had... We had Interfet troops and then UNTAID troops in Akuzi. And we had some instances where Indonesia sought to deny us those rights to go to Akuzi. And so that required a lot of legal assessment as to whether or not they could do that. We concluded that they couldn't, that we would give full effect to the Security Council resolution to ensure that the Akuzi enclave was similar, was equally as protected as what the main island or the main component of East Timor was. So as a young lawyer at the time, it was tremendously exciting to be involved in that component. And then for the second part of it, which was the PKF component, what we found was when we transitioned from Interfet to UNTAID, there arose quite a strong militia threat to the East Timorese people.
That's right, yes.
And so one of the things I needed to do as the lawyer there was to liaise with the UN Peacekeeping Office in New York at the UN to try and have an adjustment to our rules of engagement that enabled us to take a more bolder approach to the security threat. And we ended up getting changes to our ROE that enabled us an interpretation of what self-defense meant, which enabled us to react appropriately to the threat that the people of East Timor were facing by this militia, and also ourselves. So we had a number of peacekeepers that were killed and wounded in these clashes, and so we needed to be able to have the legal authority to protect ourselves and protect the people, and ultimately we got that from the Department of Peacekeeping Operations, which required a lot of legal discussion as to how far we could go lawfully in protecting the people that we needed to protect. And we ultimately got it, but it wasn't... it required a lot of legal argument.
Right? Yes, I bet too, Dale. And I think those, obviously, explaining those exciting times for you and dealing with things on a legal issue, the law is... important to us all, obviously, but very much a big part of your life. I mean, you've been a delegate to UNESCO and a doctorate from Harvard.
That's right.
How important, Dale, is the upholding of law within the warfare?
So, from the Australian perspective, our doctrine says, as you would expect, that we will act in accordance with the law. And that this is an expectation of the Australian population. At the end of the day, the Australian Defence Force represents the Australian population, the Australian people, wherever we are, and I think the Australian people fully expect that we will comply with the law. Now, when I say that, the law also provides protection to our commanders to do what they need to do to give effect to Australian policy overseas in a manner that... That is legitimate. And so to that end, I think the law is tremendously important, and it's much more... people, I think, are surprised to know that that the law, and particularly in a time of armed conflict, that the law itself is quite voluminous, it's quite dense about what you can and can't do. And so it requires a skillful approach to try and ensure that we are able to do what we can do to the fullest extent of the law, but also to ensure that our commanders know what the limits are and what they can't do and what they need to be careful about. So my life has been involved in providing legal advice to commanders at various operations, particularly overseas. And yes, in 2009, I started my doctorate at Harvard Law School. And my goal in that doctorate was to write a dissertation where I examined the manner of legal advice, the manner of the application of law, as contrasted to ethical and moral decisions that our commanders make. And I tried to find in my dissertation elements of convergence where that occurs and choices that our commanders have made over the years. And I've come to the conclusion that all of our commanders have a deep abiding respect of the law and strive to comply with it, at the same time ensuring that Australia achieves the mission outcomes that the ADF has been set. So I have a good news story. My dissertation was a good news story in the way in which law and policy and moral choice can converge. Certainly, that's been my experience with the ADF.
Mm-hmm. Yes, okay. I'm thinking, of course, Dale, a question to you, and I guess an observance from many, maybe, that around the world, particularly right now, of course, before the virus at least, because that's put a whole new slant on things, but in warfares, sure, in warfares around the world prior to the virus, there seemed to be, this is an observation from myself, a growing lack of respect for the law in warfare.
That's a standard criticism about the law of armed conflict. Mm. And so there's a number of responses I can make to that. And I don't know if it's growing, but certainly there are elements, you look at ISIS, who proudly defy the law. There's no doubt that that's what they do. From an Australian perspective, we will comply with the law of armed conflict because that's who we are. We are a country that is bound by a sense of right and wrong, and that right or wrong is reflected in legal compliance. And that, as I say, in my view, is the expectation of the Australian population.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that if you violate the law of armed conflict, there may be an immediate tactical advantage that your force might have. But in the long term, certainly where there's repeated violations of the law of armed conflict, people have enough nous to know that you are not a legitimate force, that what you have done is wrong, and that there are consequences, political consequences, moral consequences, public support consequences for violation. And, of course, we have the International Criminal Court, and if you violate the law of armed conflict and your state is a party to that statute, then there are criminal prosecution, there are criminal consequences. But that's the great role of law is, I think, in the contemporary period, it operates to bestow legitimacy or illegitimacy on a force. And in this connected world, being regarded as an illegitimate force is not a good thing. It's actually in your interest to not have that occur. And so we look at ISIS, where there was the world community united in reacting to them because of just how flagrant their violation, amongst other things, their violations of the law of armed conflict are. So I think people can rightly look at violations of the law and go, well, they seemed to get away with it, but they rarely do. Not in the long term or even in the medium term do they ever truly get away with it. And you've got organisations like the Red Cross, the International Committee of the Red Cross,
yes,
who are very engaged in dealing with particularly non-state actors who violate the law, and they are there to also act as a guardian of legal compliance, so of ensuring legal compliance. So there is a consequence, Greg, if you violate the law of armed conflict. It may not seem so immediately, but in the medium or long term, there always is.
Yes, that's reassuring to hear. And of course, Red Cross, Australian Red Cross, we're talking about now, have had a long and just a wonderful history of helping and assisting during times of war and refugees, etc. So that's always an organisation that carries a lot of weight.
It truly does, and the Red Cross, certainly the Australian Defence Force and the International Committee of the Red Cross, have a great connection, I won't say working relationship. We're different organisations, but we have always engaged with the ICRC, and we always will. And they are a reputable, honourable organisation that we respect. So yeah, I agree.
No, totally good stuff. Look, I think, I mean, as director of operational and international law, your voice must carry some weight.
One of the things I found when I was in the ADF, and you're right, I was the Director of Operations and International Law, is that you found yourself very engaged in very, very key issues at any moment of the day or night. And it was a tremendous responsibility to ensure that you and your team gave the advice that was correct, an advice which ensured that, to the greatest extent, that Australia could achieve what it needed to achieve operationally, but also in a manner that was defensible, that was compliant with the law, so that we, our commanders, would not face, you know, a criminal prosecution, but more importantly, that the ADF would always act legitimately. So, yes, it was a tremendous responsibility that I felt personally. But we have a good team in the Defence Force. We have a very good training regime, and our lawyers are trusted members of any command team. And you know, I think we do ourselves proud in what we're able to do in assisting the ADF in its mission.
Mm. Well, look, I suppose, Dale, law itself is one of the major backbones, and adherence to law, one of the major backbones of a successful democratic country. And your role in upholding that has been greatly appreciated from those within the military area and also of the general public, because it is, after all, the tenet for success as a democratic society.
Thanks, Greg.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you so much for sparing the time with us, Dale, and wishing you ongoing support with your work.
Oh, thank you very much, Greg. I appreciate it.
Thank you.